David Bohm Seminar, Saturday, March 21st, 1992, 11:30 morning session, Oak Grove School, Ojai, California.
Yes, well, these are very difficult questions that are being raised, and we're all exploring, of course. I can't say that I know the answers, or anybody does. And I wanted to say just a few things while we're talking about thought to make it focus more on what we mean. And now there are two words, thinking and thought. See, thinking is active. The word thought is the past. We've gone into this before, that thought is what has been thought. So it really goes on the memory, and the memory is active, as in the computer, or we have a reflex or a reaction. And thought is the past reacting all over the body. I mean, and we have feelings. Now, feelings, the word feeling would suggest it was always something new, but we know a lot of our feelings come from the past. We can remember traumatic experiences, or if you've been insulted, you still feel the insult quite a long time afterward, which could only be due to the memory. But it's quite active, nevertheless. It's the activity of the past. And in the past, I've suggested previously using a word like felt as thought and thinking, feeling and felt. You see, felt is what has been felt, as a thought is what has been the result of thinking. The felt is what has been the result of feeling. And so on. So and then there are other reactions from the past. So now the point is we're putting all these together under a common name. Now, some people may object that these are rather different functions, thinking, feeling, muscles, and so on. Why should we put them under a common name? Or even going outward into the society, saying it's social troubles and organizations of companies and organization of the economy. It's all thought, right, I'm saying. Now, you see, when you are thinking, then you're somewhat aware of what's happening. You know you are thinking. You have the intention to think. Say, I must think. And therefore, some of these problems are less severe, right? You're ready to see where it's not coherent, at least if you're thinking clearly, and ready to learn some other way of thinking. Learn, you know, that it's not coherent, learn what it means, and then it will give rise to different thought. So in that sense, clear thinking would be, it still involves contradiction and so on, you see, but it's being the attitude to the contradiction that counts. Now, see, all the memories go together. Though the functions may be in different parts of the brain or somewhat different, say, of thought, thinking, and feeling, in the memory they're all mixed as in a soup. I mean, I don't think there's any fundamental, to say memories about the muscles go in one part of the brain, memories of thought go in another part, memories of feeling in another part. but rather they're all, I suggest they're all mixed like in a soup. Now, they all associate together in that mixture. So that's why it's useful to give it a common name. You see, that's why the thing is so confused, because in some sense there are different functions. And if we don't see it coming out of memory, then we don't notice that though the functions are different, their origin is common. that's good, useful to give all that one name. And I'm suggesting the name, I think Krishnamurti essentially suggested that's the name thought. Because thought is the most characteristic feature of that area. In a way, you could say if you're doing something habitually, it's a kind of thoughts do it work, right? Or feelings that arise habitually, you see. But we don't see where they come from, and we treat them either as independent functions or as part of correct perception or a source of truth or something. Whereas, you see, thought cannot be a source of truth because it's the past, the activity of the past, and the past is limited. You have abstracted, the brain has, the whole humanity has abstracted certain things from the past. And also, the you know, the information is incomplete. It's to never tell the whole of what is, or even only a small aspect of what is. And insofar as there's an area which can be relatively independent, then we can use that, and then we have to see that it isn't independent, and then we may see whether we have a form of thought which takes that into account, and so on. So I think that that should make it clear what we mean by thought. Now, the intention to think can easily be conscious, but there is a kind of intention behind thought, but we don't seem to be conscious of it. Something is an urgency or an impulse, or not necessarily only intention, but also impulse. Like we have an impulse for thought, right? Which impels us, pushes us. Now, could we? I don't know if we could be aware of that.
You mean a naturally occurring impulse?
It's part of the thought itself, is the impulse. On the memory is the possibility of an impulse to think on the memory bank. And something happens, either another thought or something happening, will liberate that impulse to think and give rise to more either thinking or thought, or both.
You're asking if we could be aware of that?
Yeah, well, maybe that's too much. I don't know. You see it.
Do I hear a suggestion, because am I hearing correctly that to some extent there's a distinction between the process of thinking and thought?
Yes.
And there is an intention to engage in the process of thinking, and that intention we can be relatively easily aware of.
Mm-hmm.
But the activity of thought may be more associated with an impulse rather
yes.
than an intention.
The impulse functions like an intention.
But it may be more elusive or more mm-hmm. difficult to become aware of.
Yeah.
The thinking in some way is the feedback mirror to see the impulse.
What?
The thinking that's unfolding from the impulse is reflective of the impulse in some way.
Yes.
So it is, it's a potential feedback environment before becoming more sensitive to the impulse.
Yeah, so you have the possibility that, you know, you want to think, or and you get various things happen, and then you're aware. It's not so different from the awareness of the movement of the body, you see. In fact, you could argue that, say, is thought a material process, or is it purely something spiritual or ethereal? See, I think the general tendency is to regard thought as something immaterial, and therefore quite distinct from matter. And when we produce various material systems like computers which engage in a kind of thought, see, I don't know that they ever think, but engage in thinking, but...
I have a metaphor sometimes that's helpful for playing with this, is as if envision a hula hoop that was magnetic, big magnet, and a body full of iron filings, right? And that as this hula hoop went up and down around your body, these filings come up and can stow into different forms. And in some sense, I have that experience moving through the world with what these impulses are.
Yes, you may get an impulse to think. I don't know where it might be, in the head or in the body. It's rather hard to get hold of, because the impulses, these are reflexes, and reflexes are very hard to be aware of.
If you were hungry, you would start having an impulse to think about food.
Yes.
And so that would be demonstrable on a very gross level, that there could be a movement in the body
mm-hmm.
called hunger that would cause one to start
yeah.
thinking about...
And we have that's right. And we have the other movement when that whole system is disturbed psychologically, where hunger can be produced psychologically by a feeling of emptiness, the thought of emptiness, which then stirs up the reflex of the stomach is empty, you see. And so therefore you eat and it doesn't satisfy you, and so on. You see, it becomes very hard to get that clear. That the reflexes are all mixed together, the reflex of the stomach and so on. And Joe was talking about people with different multiple personalities, but all the personalities are probably mixed together on the memory, but there may be different functions in different parts.
Do we ever not think?
Well, most of it is thought, you see.
It seems like the the emptiness is always being filled up by the thought. The thought itself, the program, and the memory fills up the emptiness. And if it didn't, if we could keep the emptiness, keep the space, there's room for thinking. We might be aware of fresh thinking.
Well, then you have to be aware of the arising of this kind of movement, otherwise you'd be caught up in it.
Yes, well, that's really the question. Can we be aware of the arising of thought?
We go back to this, the idea that, how would you say, there's an impulse that creates thought.
Activates
thought. Then when you made that comment about thought being immaterial, I was wondering if you were suggesting that impulse arises materially.
Yes, well, but is thought immaterial is the first question. You see, that's part of our tradition, that it is immaterial. At least implicitly, people treat it that way. Now, that may produce fragmentation, because if thought is material and we say it's immaterial, then we're fragmenting.
It seems that thought has to be material because it's embodied in the brain cells as the past, but thinking, and here, talking about thinking analytically, say on where and how we're going to build a bridge or construct a building, and looking at all that's involved there, must be more real energy.
Well, it may be, yeah.
Utilizing the past somewhat, but...
Well, if the thinking is very clear, you see, it's usually a mixture of thinking and thought. Now, thinking may involve being able to see incoherence. Now, we may, of course, try to list all the possible kinds of incoherence and put them on the memory, but we can't really. Because there are always new subtle forms of incoherence.
Is there anything that's immaterial?
I don't know. See, I'm trying to say... people have proposed, I don't know whether we should discuss this now, but it's a long discussion in philosophy. You see, whether all is material, that's a materialist position, or whether mind or spirit is beyond matter. And matter, now, a large part of our tradition, which, you know, we're not going to say it's right or wrong, is that spirit is beyond matter.
There is something beyond
matter.
Do you think mind and spirit are the same?
Well, not necessarily, no, but they're, in some, mind could be just matter if you want to make it that way. If you say it's all thought, it could be a material process.
Well, how does the question whether it's material or immaterial impinge upon the problems that we're trying to understand?
Yes, well, you see, if we're treating thought as immaterial, then in a sense we're treating it as a possible source of truth, you see. I think that the implication of all that is that truth does not arise in the material system.
We would be putting it in a much higher order of value, saying that it was immaterial, that somehow it was in relationship with that thing that we say is created all the material.
Yeah.
Which would give it a tremendous meaning and value.
Yes, and in fact, we do give it that meaning, you see.
Part of the problem is linguistic, too, because I mean, if you take the connectionist idea of the thought, thinking, is actually not embodied in brain cells, but has to do with the connections between the neurons.
Yes, but I was...
Now, is that connection, is what connects up, is that matter, or is it material, or is it immaterial?
Well, according to...
Really?
Well, according to the present theories of the brain, it's a material process. You see, it's all electrochemical connections or various other kinds, and you know, hormones and...
The ordering of it somehow or another.
Well, then that's something else again,
yeah,
you see. But you see, we tend to say at some stage it passes matter, but then the ordering could also be put on the memory and then become material.
That's how I'd say the difference is a linguistic problem more than it is a very likely a real problem.
Well, a linguistic problem is a real problem because it misleads us.
One of the problems is we talk about matter and material as if we knew what it meant.
Yes.
And we do mean a certain thing by it, but if I try to reach into matter or the material, it's not so clear. You know, see, we say, well, it's concrete. But then, is anything concrete?
Well, nothing that thought treats is concrete. See, thought can only treat the abstract, right? It can only abstract, right? But it refers to the concrete in principle. That distinction is part of thought. And we discussed it before, the word concrete has a root concrescent grown together. It's all something all very rich. And we abstract from that the things which may be relevant to us. And then they should refer back to the concrete. I'm stating the picture which we are using. It's part of our reflex system.
I wonder if there might be a relationship between the impulse to think or thought and pleasure, the sensation of pleasure or pain, and that might also connect to the question of what is material and what is matter.
Well, there very likely is a connection to pleasure or pain in the sense that incoherence is felt as painful sometimes and very often, and then there is a move to try to deal with that. Now, that might make sense in the, like if you have a toothache, the pain indicates something is wrong, and we have to deal with it. Right? Now, so if the thought is, if the process is clear, then we find the right thing. But the pain may be caused by thought itself, right?
Before about emptiness, if someone were to experience emptiness either individually or in a group, where things sort of subside for a minute,
mm-hmm.
there's a space there that becomes uncomfortable. That same thing transpires internally. And as soon as thought enters the process and names it as uncomfortable,
mm-hmm.
there's an immediate sensation that it is.
Yes.
As whereas if it didn't enter at that point, there might be a new sense of a different possibility of what could happen.
Yes, I mean, the naming of the thing has a very powerful effect. It affects the way you see it, right? Perceive it.
Yeah.
And that affects what happens.
So if I say emptiness is uncomfortable, that's my association.
Yeah.
And if it's deep enough that it's at a reflex level, then I don't even see it anymore. But every time there is a space or emptiness, thought will move to fill it.
Yes, or if there's the possibility of it, the thought process as its content that there may be a space, then thought will move, even whether there is or not.
What is it trying to do when it does that?
What does it try to do? Well, to create the impression that it's full, right? I mean, you may have memories of things that are full and memories of things that are empty, states of emptiness, right? Now, the state of being satisfied and full and, content, full of content, you can see that the sort of thing that thought could then say produce some sort of memory which would have that in its reflex, or it would produce thoughts which were conducive to that.
One view, if one took the definition of thought that you mentioned earlier, the inclusive idea of thought, thinking, feeling, felt, and so on, and gave that a slightly different name and called it me, then one could see the need. One could see very clearly why it wants to move from emptiness to fullness. Because I think our sense of me and mm-hmm. identity is very much a part of that system that we're calling thought.
Yes, the question is whether thought is necessarily identified with me. I mean, it certainly is, in fact.
Yeah.
But it might be possible for thought to take place without that identification.
Not so keen to fill up the space all the time, maybe. Or you might be partaking of a different space. There may be other spaces besides fullness and emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me at this point that one difficulty we might have is some of the matters that are being talked about right here, we might think that these could be understood in thinking. And this might be a serious error, because we could be trying to understand what you're saying or what this other gentleman said about emptiness in thinking.
Mm-hmm.
and I wouldn't realize that I've made a gross mistake.
What we can understand is how thought creates the illusion. You know, that we can understand to some extent by thinking.
I'm not suggesting we not think,
yeah,
but apparently something else is going to be is called for simultaneously with what I generally regard as thinking, or I'll just continue to make a series of images thinking I know what is meant and never actually going into the territory where the actual phenomena occurs.
I think one of these gentlemen was really moving toward the why. I found it rather interesting that he was trying to find out why it's happening. He was suggesting that perhaps the reason it's happening is because thought sort of seamlessly blends into what we think is me, and as a result, we have that problem. I'm speaking for you, but I thought you were trying to go to the why as opposed to...
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that is the thing that makes thought so difficult, that it really is the thought of the self. Now, we could say perhaps there is no self, you see, or perhaps there is one, but even if there is one, the thought of the self is not the self. And the thought of the self can produce, however, a very great evidence of activity and feeling and so on, which could be taken as proof that it knows what the self is. You know.
Do you see any way that we could find out if there is a self other than thought?
Well, it's as long as we are not able to be free of the sense of self which is in thought, I don't know what we could say.
It seems that an implication I had was that the self, whatever that is, what it feels comfortable when it feels full. So it's always creating whatever it is, activities, thoughts, to have this sense of fullness and satisfaction, and perhaps the sense of emptiness or void might be threatening to the sense of self.
Which is actually a thought of self.
Yes, well, why should the thought be frightened of that? You see, you have to see there's an illusion going on. There's a deception going on of some kind. Now, see, the word self, you know, the thing itself, it means, its fundamental meaning is the quintessence. You know, there were four essences in medieval times, and then the fifth one was the essence of all. And so the thing itself is the quintessence of the thing, right? We use it in that term. So the self would be the essence, which is the true being of whoever you are. Now that would be very important, you see. And the self is supported by a concept. You know, there's not only the word myself, you see, but there's the words I and me. You see, I is the subject. It represents the source of action and thought. You know, the holder of intentions, and it's really while me represents the object to whom it all happens, right? And the concept is that say me, myself, and I are one, right? See, that makes a concept of the self, right? And now there's difficulty in that. If the quintessence is there, that must be supremely important and precious, right? And highly necessary.
Do we get into areas of power and powerlessness when we start to consider the self and its needs and projections?
Yes, power is one of the questions, you see. But that's, I is the source of power, and me is the one on whom power is exercised. We would rather be the source of power than the one on whom it's exercised most of the time. Although, then other people would prefer to have power exercised on them. They don't have the responsibility. So the point is that power in itself is a neutral term, but when it gets connected to this notion of the me or the I, then it takes on a different significance. Now, in society, some people have power and some don't. Now, it can have some very good pleasant consequences to have power, and also some unpleasant ones, and vice versa, with lack of power. Now, the lack of power will produce a feeling of fear, or panic at times, because then you're in danger. You're in danger physically. See, the me also refers to the body, and it's supposed to end at the skin. But then the me can refer further to my country, or my possessions, my family, and so on. So it can be all of those can be attributed to the me, as belonging to the me. See, so therefore your country can take over and take on the value that the me has, or the I. But I think the key point there is it's logical anyway that I am is the tremendous significance. We've discussed that when Moses was getting on the mountain, and God was talking to Moses, and Moses asked, "What is your name?" And he said, "My name is I am." You see, that was literally what it said. And he said, "Who shall I say I am that I am?" And when Moses said, "When I go to the tribes of Israel, who shall I say sent me?" And he said, "You shall say that I am sent you." It's written in quotes, you see. So I am is the appropriate name of God, right? Because it's the source of all power, all intention, all the subtle things, all the spirit. See, that's what it means, right? Now, whether the meaning is correct or not is another question, but the meaning is what acts, right? According to the meaning. And then we've often discussed this. The world says, see, the little child feels in some sense that he or she is God. And at a certain stage, society says, "You're not God. Who do you think you are? You're just little you. You're not the great I am." You see that? See, people do recognize this fact, right? And now, if I am were there, it would be something glorious and wonderful. Perhaps the child thinks that way. But it's just as you might think of God, right? Now, that goes on to the reflex, right? And later goes on the reflex, "You're only me. I'm only me, little me and the great I am." Evidently, these things are very important. It's not merely intellectual, but these are all in the memory, so they're connected with very powerful surges of feeling, adrenaline, all sorts of things. Sense of necessity.
Mm-hmm. I exist.
Yes, and the body is here too.
Yes, that just a sense of being present and existing that may not be connected with the ego or the self, but somehow they get very much connected up.
In the memory, you see. That is, the sense of existence must also go on to the memory. And then it would be put as I exist, right? I am exist, right?
But if that sense of existence is genuine, in addition to being put on the memory, it's always there in the living present.
That's right, yes. But then it can always be switched. See, so that the memory becomes more important than the actual existence. When people sacrifice their lives for their country or whatever.
Is this similar to what you were saying this morning earlier about this observation without the observer, that there may be some sense of existence without one who exists?
Maybe so. Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Well, one might say that the root of this whole misconception thing we're talking about is the fact that we do have a feeling of existence. Or there, thought starts extrapolating all kinds of meanings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As in, not only do I exist, but I exist separately, and I exist, and then as soon as I say I exist separately, then I have all this to defend, because the only thing I have is my separate existence, and then I come up with all kinds of philosophies and psychology. So that there is a feeling of being out of which thought, instead of just being whatever it is, a little computer guider of our being in relationship to what happens, it's turned into an entity in itself, using that feeling as a springboard for its validity.
Yes. The feeling I exist might originally be the same as proprioception. and then it goes on the memory. And then without noticing it, I begin to use the memory for the feeling that I exist.
Is that the right way to say it, the feeling that I exist? Or is there simply the feeling, the awareness? I mean, I can't deny that there's an awareness here.
Yes.
There's that. But then to say, I exist, I've already taken a step into an image.
Yeah. Well, if you use the language that way, but there would be a feeling that body exists and has a certain relative independence of the surroundings. You know, in the early days, as far as we can tell, people didn't feel that separation so much. You know, except, and then as civilization developed, the sense of separation increased because there was more and more focus on these words and the use of thought.
Okay, but now, just as I'm sitting here, I try to find out, what do I have here? And all I can say is, well, there's something here, there's an awareness. I'm using that word, I don't know, use some word.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't deny it. But anything I say after that, I've gone into thinking.
Yes. Is it correct thinking or not, you see, or is it deceptive thinking? Because even to say this, we're going into thinking.
Thinking has taken that organismic awareness of its own existence and used it as a basis to prove that it exists separately. That's the difficulty. Not that we exist or that we think, but the thought has taken this feeling of existence and extrapolated this great psychological entity called me that has to be protected at all costs.
Okay. But when I first have this awareness, and I have to do it each time or I don't have it.
The awareness is having itself all.
Whatever you want to call it. I'm using words to refer to something.
Well, yeah, okay.
Okay. That it's not too difficult to see that only if I start thinking, going into an image about it, can I say that I exist. Prior to that, I can't even say that I exist. Mm. It's just.
But that would be a reasonable thought to say I exist.
It sounds as if you're giving a derogatory aura to.
What, that I exist?
No. Right after that, I begin to think. The process of thought, there's no value judgment. The process of thought is an extraordinary thing in itself, and I know I do this myself, and I've done it in the past. The notion that thought is not a good thing enters into our discussion fairly often without our even realizing it.
Yeah.
And that was the sense I was getting from you, Enrico, that you said right after I begin to think as if you were doing something improper.
Okay.
And Michael was suggesting that was a thought that makes sense. So
the improperness is to add that element of time, because you're not doing them separate. You are being, you are thinking. Those are the same process. But to say I'm being and I'm thinking automatically is that movement of incorrectness. But to say in my being thinking is too, I don't know how you would say it. You're not creating a separation. I think that's where the difficulty is. I am here and then I think. No, I am here thinking. I am here being. I'm here and then I be.
Well,
you couldn't say that.
Maybe whether thought becomes self-referential or not, I mean, and running away on its own, or whether it continues to be informed by the being, and, you know, in the sense of like even in the nervous system, an open dialogue between silent levels, the silent orders of abstraction and the higher orders of abstraction, that is, in a sense, they become... they inform one another. I mean, I think that whether thought becomes problematic or not has to do with what it has as its reference.
So I could say I exist, but that's only a way of speaking. It isn't experienced as a reality of I exist.
The saying of it isn't the reality.
Hmm?
The saying of it isn't the reality. The saying of it is an expression of a perception of the reality. To say I exist would be meaningless if I didn't exist. It would be impossible if I didn't exist. So existence is. What I say, how I act, how I do is part of that existence. Is that?
You know, it seems that there is a, there can be awareness, a thoughtless awareness of existence, and there can be thought, which is the past, the content of consciousness, saying that I am existing. Then there can be the present now thinking that I'm existing, and there can be just a perception that I'm here, which is without thinking.
I wonder if it might be any help or use to give attention to the words. I think you were suggesting something about I before, the use of I. It occurred to me that when we, you know, in talking about all of this, about consciousness and existence, we keep using the word I exist, and it seems to me that may be part of the problem of confusion, because could perhaps the statement be something like, there is a perception of existence. The I keeps implying something that is the existent, an object of existence. It seems to me the language is partly responsible for, I mean, if we're struggling to, if we're working towards a perception of what is, it seems to me that we have to be very, very conscious, very careful about the language, because the language has all of these implications and structures and thought, dynamics, all of that mixed in with it. And it seems to me we keep, there's a danger of getting stuck in that, causing confusion.
David, you were saying before that one way of looking at I is that it is the source.
Yes.
Right? And if that's the meaning for an individual, then there can be a perception that it is only the source when there is some activity going on.
But the activity, maybe action, maybe inward, of course.
Yes, internally. But that could be thinking, for instance. I could say that the source exists when it is producing thinking, right?
Yeah.
So if that's my meaning.
But that's Descartes.
Right. If that's my meaning, though, I'm going to always want to be thinking, because that's where I'm comfortable.
Yeah.
And that's my meaning of I. Otherwise, if it subsides, then I have a different dimension which seems to be in conflict with my original meaning.
Yeah, well, people, you know, like the Eskimos say this one, but of course they use it in the same sense of I, but say that the word I means this particular individual, and it also means the source, something greater. And it goes on to the reflexes, and it produces a sense of existence. Now, whether in the reflex, and usually I think that then the thought refers back to that sense of existence, as if it were independent, right?
That may be critical in this, that if the feeling of existence becomes dependent upon a false stimulation rather than its intrinsic there, which it apparently is the case that existence is there without the reflex is having to tell it it's there. But if it then becomes dependent upon the reflex is telling it it's there, that seems to be the very structure of the me.
Yeah, of identity, yeah.
So there was another, call it conditioning, that judgment that was introduced, and usually talk about this at the end of things, so I don't know if this is jumping ahead, but the sense of time as perhaps being a more fundamental or primary conditioning than the sense of the self. So there may be a perception of existence, and then there may be even a sense of self, but the continuity that time introduces, I was, I am, I will be, adds another element of, well, complexity or confusion to the whole human experience.
Are we trying to figure out whether or not we acknowledge that there's a fog of confusion surrounding the self. And if I follow the drift of the conversation, it seems like we're trying to ascertain whether somewhere within that fog there's some actuality of existence which is real and not part of the fog. But that seems, is that not a waste of energy if that's what we're doing? Why don't we just work on dispelling the fog? And then if we've done that, if something's left over, great. But not worry about whether there's something real in there, get rid of the fog.
Maybe we should bear witness to what the I am is for one person personally. It seems like what we share are thoughts, like what we're doing now, but what seems like what we're trying to do is to share the I am. To me, that's probably the scariest thing, where the ego, the little s and the big s, get all confused. But for me, my I am, is a deep and formless knowing. It is a well from which springs, and it's indistinguishable from anything else. And so, in the effort to express this, the effort is to break down the barriers and that seem to be up against the self. There's no doubt, there's no fog when we are with our I am. There's just no doubt. It's a deep and formless knowing for everybody. But I think there is like a pile of shit around it, you know. But I think that it would be really interesting for me if I could hear other people share their I ams, you know, say who you are, who you think you are, what it is to be, you know, what it is that, what is truth, what is goodness, what is oneness, you know. It's like this is what we're really all trying to do, and it's, you know, it's a lot of bullshit, but it is really cosmic. I mean, it's all there is. You know? I mean, I don't feel like we're doing anything trivial, you know, at all. Yet it all seems so trivial. I remember this Nietzsche said he was caught between two nothings. You know, like the I am seems to be such a nothing, such a void. You know, all the Oriental mystics, it's like you have to have no thought. You have to get rid of, you have to empty yourself, and then it seems you're left with nothing. But when you enter this world of talk and conversation and concepts, it all seems to be nothing too. And that's like the nothing that we get caught in between. It's a painful experience to be a human being, to be caught between these two nothings. And it seems like this is where we're playing, and it's a great place to be.
There's something that's not part of thought or consciousness. Thought knows nothing about it and can't discuss it. It's not part of thought, it's not part of consciousness. And for thought to try to discuss it, it's just deceiving itself. There's nothing that can be said about it because we're using an instrument which can't know it.
What do we do?
I kind of bit to imitate it.
Where is the place of perception in all this? You know, the few instants that our minds aren't grinding along. What about that? Where does that fit in?
As well, it's hard to perceive because of all this stuff around it, but and also because the thought process projects its own content into perception, so that what you see is, you know, what thought is projecting into, attributing. Now, see, the question is, how are we going to? We usually come to this much later, but how are we going to get an actual perception? Have an actual perception of this whole complex or whatever it is.
Not just constantly assumptions and constantly conclusions, but still raising as clear and accurate questions as possible to the relative, to what we need to understand, and stay with the question. Because thought is so busy and so impulsive to jump and give, even if we say raise question, it raises question and very quickly gives the answer. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is a fabrication of the thought, has nothing to do with perception. But if I start watching that thought is raising questions, thought is answering, then that may help the thought raise the question, formulate the relative question as clearly as accurately as possible, but stay with the question. Can that help the perception?
Yes. I think that we won't get to an answer to this, you know, at least very quickly. And if we can stay with it and mull it over and come back to it again and so on, that would be helpful. But what we've been doing so far is to look at how thought creates this illusion. Illusion about the self, right? What can we do? Can we see this immediately?
It seems to me that this late morning is quite an interesting experience, because an awful lot of very interesting things were said here this morning, I think, and very interesting from a lot of different quarters. And unfortunately, they're committed to memory.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, and what you're suggesting now is how can we, now that we've talked about it, and we've wonderful things were said, now what's the next step?
Maybe this is the next step.
Yes, reaching the
end.
Well, okay, it's lunch or something. Yeah. Okay.